This is Tridio Media, and I'm Father Roderick, and it is a not-so-warm day in Amersfoort, the Netherlands. From Star Wars to the sacraments, from technology to theology, this show features the cool and the classical, the past and the future, the trends and the tradition. I'm Father Roderick. I've been podcasting since 2005. Welcome to my show. This show is brought to you free of advertisements, you know, those nagging, annoying advertisements for mattresses and all sorts of ingredients that they bring to your house and then so you can cook without having to go to the stores and that sort of stuff. We don't do that because we have patrons and they allow me to do this work. If you want to join the community of patrons, then please check out patreon.com/FatherRoderick. And this week, special word of thanks to John for being a patron, even though this past week he had to lower his support. Sometimes at the beginning of the month, people do that because, well, their financial situation changes. And I'm always hoping that if some people have to step away from Patreon or have to lower their monthly contribution, that other people will step up and join the community. So this might be a good occasion. Thank you so much. Let's take a look at the news.
Do you know what's going on? This is what's happening in your world.
Face it, Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
Lots of new things happening here at the Tridio Studios in the Netherlands. The biggest change when it comes to my work here is that I don't have to press any buttons today. Inge is sitting at her desk as the producer of the show, and she's taking care of launching the live stream and interacting with the chat room, and also pressing the jingle buttons on the iPad. So I can focus on what I want to tell you, and I can focus on the show itself, which I can already tell is a massive advantage over having to do everything myself, because, well, I'm kind of scatterbrained, and if I have too many things to take care of, then oftentimes the contents will suffer, or my concentration will suffer. So that's really cool. Another kind of a bit of a setback here at Tridio is that our Camino documentary that we were developing for the month of June will probably be postponed a little bit. And this has to do with the way that we are producing this. I filmed my Camino de Santiago using my iPhone. In fact, I actually took a real camera with me, a small Sony camera, but it broke down after a couple of days. I don't know if it was the humidity or just the kind of lousy build quality of the camera, because it was already the second one. The first one started to have problems after just a week. So I brought it back, got another one, and I think that the second camera had similar problems. It's just not sturdy enough. So while it did film, it sometimes didn't save the file, or it saved it as a corrupt file. And that's, of course, the last thing you want. If you are going through extraordinary experiences and you film it and then you discover that that wonderful sunset that you can only see once every century is now saved as a corrupted file and you can't use it anymore, that is too much of a risk. So fortunately, I had my iPhone with me. I wasn't planning on using the iPhone for filming, but fortunately, it did have a very good back camera. The front camera is still 720p, so that's pretty lousy. I used it every once in a while, but the front camera was actually quite good and could film in HD. But the only downside is of filming with the phone, there is a difference between the American and the European, or let's say the American broadcast system and the rest of the world, because that's kind of how it is, like Fahrenheit and Celsius. So the American broadcast system, and this is linked also to the frequency of the electricity in the U.S. or in North America, is either 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second. Whereas in Europe, it is 25 frames per second or 50 frames per second. Well, you can already guess what happens. The iPhone, of course, is an American product, and so it will record video 30 frames per second, which is perfectly fine if you want to air that on American television. However, my TV show is aired in the Netherlands, and so I have to use footage that runs at 25 frames per second. So you have to convert stuff. And one of the problems was that I was first filming with the Sony camera 25 frames per second, and then I switched to the iPhone 30 frames per second. And my editor is using Avid, which is a very honorable but also quite old or at least ancient system for editing. It exists for decades now. And so it's kind of like what Windows used to do. Like every new version used to add new functionality while trying to keep the old functionality. And the big problem is that Avid, even though it is very powerful, it's used for editing, even like most blockbusters are edited with Avid. It also has a lot of quirks, and it's not at all flexible when it comes to the output. Nowadays, of course, frame rates don't really matter if you are watching your stuff on YouTube or on Vimeo or on Facebook, because all those programs are basically agnostic when it comes to frame rate. So it will look good no matter what kind of frame rate your original footage has. But Avid is made for television, and so it has a great deal of trouble converting stuff that is filmed in 30 frames per second to 25 and vice versa. So I was watching the first episode that our editor had compiled, and like a lot of the stuff that I filmed in 25p just looked blurry. And the software was superimposing images to try to kind of smooth it out, but it didn't do a very good job. So I tried the same thing in Adobe Premiere, which is a much, much newer program. And Adobe just takes whatever footage you put in there, and it's only at the end of the entire process that it will convert it to whatever frame rate you want. And so it is much smarter at converting it, and it does it without, you know, making the footage blurry. The problem is my editor does not work with Adobe Premiere. So we're still trying to figure out what to do now, whether we have to switch, try to recompile everything in Premiere. It's a lot of hassle. So we've decided to temporarily halt the production of that documentary until we find a good solution, because we are going to do these monthly productions every month. And I want them to be future-proof. So I ideally, if we would make a documentary, let's say we'll do another, we'll make a Lord of the Rings documentary. And then we get an American channel that says, well, we'd love to show that on our TV channel, but it needs to be delivered in NTSC. So, you know, the American frame rate. Then if we have edited everything in Avid, we would have a problem because the conversion would always result in a degradation of the image quality. So we should probably figure out a way to move over to Adobe Premiere. But that's hard if you have an editor who is only familiar with Avid and has no plans of changing. So that's why you'll have to wait a little bit. It's going to be very cool, though. And with that, it's only a logical step to the world of movies and TV shows.
How do you not like movies?
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl, and that kid sees dead people, and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm gonna give it to you.
It's rare that I don't like movies that I watch at the cinema, but for the second time in a row, I've watched a movie in theaters, which made me extremely unhappy. Actually, I kind of expected this to be not entirely not my taste, but this was one of those movies where halfway through, I was actually ready to walk away. That's how much I disliked this movie. And of course, once you know which movie I'm talking about, most of you will say, well, duh, father, you shouldn't even go to a movie like that. Well, I'm talking about Deadpool 2, which is a sequel to Deadpool, which was kind of a surprise hit a couple of years ago based on a Marvel comic book hero, which already in comic book form had a very nasty reputation. It was kind of this the story, but also the language that was used, the topics, it was all very, very mature. And it seemed to me that the appeal was mostly breaking the rules. It's kind of like what kids like to do, you know, when they say dirty words. They don't care about the dirty words, but they care about the shocked expression on the faces of their parents. Where did you learn that language? And what kind of friends are you talking to in school? And I want you to stop talking about that. And the more you say that as parents, the more kids will say, well, I'm going to say it anyway. and then run away. At least I'm talking about my own childhood, of course, here. Well, Deadpool, in a way, to me, comes across as a franchise that does mostly that. It shocks because it wants to shock, because it knows it makes people so uncomfortable and nervous that they'll start laughing. Or, in my case, are starting to fall asleep because I'm like, this is so juvenile and so immature and gross. Gross. The first movie was very gross. Lots of blood and beheadings and intestines flying around. And irreverent, extremely low to the ground, we would say in the Netherlands, but extremely vulgar in its language and its humor. I was kind of in. The only reason that I wanted to see Deadpool 2 is that it is part of the Marvel universe, and so far I've seen all the Marvel movies. Even though Deadpool himself is not really integrated into the universe that Disney is pushing, and kind of Deadpool would not match the Disney approach to storytelling. I don't think you'll ever see a Deadpool walking around in Disneyland, at least not a licensed one. But in this case, the first movie, the only thing that was interesting was how they were able to create a major blockbuster, because it was a massive success, with an R-rated movie with an extremely small budget. Deadpool 2 also had a very small budget, so small that they weren't even able to do a 3D conversion. So this is a 2D Marvel movie. It's very rare. It had nothing new. It's kind of a little bit the same kind of criticism that I had on Jurassic World, The Lost Kingdom. It's just a rehash of stuff that we've already seen. The only difference between Deadpool 1 and Deadpool 2 is that it's even grosser, it's even more vulgar, and less funny. It's really, I didn't think it was very funny. It's probably because I'm too old for this kind of stuff. I'm sitting there and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that people pay to watch this. It's even violence and vulgar language and vulgar jokes, they get tiresome after a while. They're like, yeah. Grow up. Lots of people in the theater, though, seem to like it, because there was nervous laughter and snickering, and some parents probably wondered why they are watching this with their kids, because the guy at the counter didn't tell them that this was a movie not for kids. There was lots of breaking of the fourth wall, so it's a very self-aware movie, but that was mildly funny in the first movie. In the second one, it's just, again, we've already seen this. We know that the main superhero knows that he's actually a superhero character and that the whole universe is fake. The only time that I laughed or kind of smiled was during the credits. There was this, how do you say that? Like a little surprise moment during the credits where Deadpool is fixing something that was wrong with the way both the actor and the character of Deadpool were introduced in the past in the superhero universe. And the way they joked with that was funny. But that was very much the very end of the movie, and the rest was basically a waste of my time. So, of course, as a Catholic priest, I cannot tell you enough that you should avoid this horribly vulgar movie, which is not good for your soul. And of course, I was only watching it to be able to give you a very negative review here on the show. I think it's time to go to the world of games, quickly.
The humanoid must not escape.
Safer territory. I know that I'm going to get emails about this. God, but a Catholic priest who goes to Deadpool 2. Well, we already knew that he was lost with his Star Wars stuff, but now we know it for sure. All right. Well, pray for me if that's what you think. Last week was also the week of E3, the biggest computer games convention in the world. And a lot of the big players, Nintendo, Sony, Square Enix, Bethesda, and Microsoft were showing a lot of games in development. That was one of the surprises. There were a lot of announcements of games in development, but with no launching date. So you see something, like they show you this massive bar of chocolates, etc., and then they tell you, well, you'll get this eventually, but perhaps not today, perhaps not tomorrow, perhaps not even next year. And it's just cruel because there were a lot of great games. I think the slickest, the best done show for me was Microsoft with the Xbox. Even though the Xbox is now in its final phase and Microsoft has already mentioned that they are developing a new console, so the follow-up to Xbox, which will come out probably 2020 or something like that. They are still developing really A-grade games so that people will, of course, continue to buy those games and buy the systems in case they haven't done so already. For me, the highlight was a new Halo game. I love the Halo franchise. I've been playing a lot of the Halo games in the past. But I really hope it comes out on PC. Actually, I expect it to come out on PC as well, because Microsoft nowadays has a strategy in which they will make every game both for the Xbox and for PC. They want that cross-pollination between the two platforms. Gears of War, never cared for it. Forza, even more boring. I don't care about fast cars. Probably because I have a very slow car. Devil May Cry 5 and Sekiro are Japanese titles. I'm not really interested in that. And there was a very big surprise called Cyberpunk 2077, which I think, judging from the reaction, the public reaction on social media, was the most popular new franchise that was introduced. They didn't give away much, but it just looked very cool and different. And, well, with all the sequels and prequels out there, any new IP, intellectual property, is welcome, also in the world of video games. Unfortunately, very big disappointment. No word about virtual reality or augmented reality. I really think that Microsoft is missing the boat here. But perhaps they're waiting for the new console. Perhaps in their eyes, it's just the technology is not there yet, which I actually don't agree with, because I'm still a very enthusiastic user of my Oculus Go. It's one of those devices that I do not regret buying, and I am having so much fun with that whole new genre of entertainment in immersive 3D. But none of that in the Microsoft Xbox presentation. Then, of course, the big rival of Microsoft, PlayStation, for the PlayStation 4. They managed to anger tens of thousands of Fortnite players, because if you play Fortnite on the PlayStation 4, you will not be able to use your credentials to log in on other devices, like, for instance, the very popular Nintendo, the mobile Nintendo, what's it called again? The Nintendo, I forgot. The Switch, there you go. I don't have a Switch because I'm kind of not really a Nintendo person. I was in seminary when the Nintendo became big, so it's just not part of my upbringing. But for a lot of people, Nintendo, the Switch is what they have as a secondary console. And so the fact that on the Switch you have to create a new Fortnite account and you cannot use all the dance passes, the costumes, etc., that you purchased on your PlayStation 4 is a massive a disappointment and a reason for many people to be very angry with Sony. And Sony is still holding off. They're like, we don't promise anything. We're listening to the fans. Well, that's not a very good move to do that. They did showcase some very cool demos. Spider-Man, long anticipated, very anticipated new game based on Spider-Man. Apparently, they got the slinging, the web slinging. They nailed it. It feels very much like you are Spider-Man. The rest seemed a little bit too, I don't know, quick-timey to me. Just a lot of movies that you're watching and then you have to press the right button at the right time. That was the major flaw of a lot of other Spider-Man and in general, superhero-based games. So I don't know. It wouldn't be enough for me. For what I've seen doesn't convince me that I need to play it. Not to mention that I don't have PlayStation 4 anymore. Another demo that had a big impact on people was The Last of Us Part 2. The Last of Us is a zombie genre game, but it had a very strong narrative. It featured the story of a teenage girl who loses everyone because the zombies ate their family, and then she is kind of adopted by a man who is protecting her, and you have to play both characters, I think, to survive the zombies. And this is a sequel to that story. But the thing that made a big impression and that caused a lot of chatter on social media was not the zombie part of it or the story part, but it was a kiss between two girls, a romantic kiss between two girls, which was shown in a very long trailer. Sony had these very long demos, too long, in my opinion, where they showed basically part of how do you call that? Like a scene, just a pre-rendered scene. And it told the story. You see the girl of The Last of Us with another girl and they're dancing and then they kiss. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, it's the first time that we've ever seen this in a video game. And how courageous of Sony to do that, or Sony or the game developer to do that. So it was a lot of talk about that. It shows that also video games are part of our current entertainment culture, where it's almost as if entertainment culture is catching up with the way our society is evolving, and the shifting views and perspectives on relationships and sexuality and all that, I'm thinking in Dutch. I'm trying to say things in English. Gender. There you go. Gender. Why? So the whole gender discussion is also reflected in our entertainment. And it's almost nowadays in every movie, every TV show, it's kind of like a trope almost. Like there always has to be one of the main characters who is gay or transgender. And I think in many ways we've seen the same thing happening a bit earlier when it comes to discrimination, racism, etc. That became like every Spielberg movie needed to have the token Asian guy, the token African-American person. And you could not do a show just about white guys. And so in a certain way, you see that same thing happening. And some people are upset about that. And I'm always like, well, you know, that's what culture is. Entertainment culture is a reflection of our general society and the topics that are important to people nowadays. You see the same with Star Trek, Star Trek Discovery, for instance. A lot of people were upset about Star Trek Discovery because, well, there's so many things that are not, shouldn't be part of Star Trek. And then I'm thinking, well, Star Trek has always been a reflection of what was going on in society. It's just that nowadays we look at the stuff that was important in the 60s and we're thinking, poof, that's old-fashioned. And the same, I think, is going to happen 20 years from now when people look back at this day and age and the kind of content and TV shows and movies that were produced. And it was like, oh, that was typical for that, you know, 2000. That's so 2018. Like every video game would have a lesbian kiss or something like that. See what I mean? It's a part of the way the entertainment industry works. And I would go even further, and that is if you would always, some people want Disney and Marvel and you name it to kind of stay a reflection of the norms and the values that were all the kind of were normal in the 50s or in the 60s. But we have to be honest, and society is changing, so is culture, and so are the expressions of culture. And of course, as a Catholic, I will have my own opinion about that. But you cannot expect as a Catholic that the entire entertainment world will conform to your view of norms and of values and of morality. What the church has always done is to create its own culture. sometimes as a counterpoint to the dominant culture. Sometimes it will take elements from the modern culture and integrate it and transform it. But just being opposed because the world is not evolving in the way that you would like to see it evolve and then blame the media or blame the entertainment industry for that, I think that's misjudging how it works. Entertainment, video games, movies, TV shows, they're a reflection of what's going on in society. And, I was talking about E3, Bethesda, very cool. Of course, they made Fallout. There's a new installment, Fallout 76. I love that universe. Also, The Elder Scrolls, there's a new installment that was announced, but the glimpse was too short. And there was a new franchise, Starfield, sci-fi game. That's kind of cool. Nintendo, I totally skipped on that. I think there was a Super Smash Brothers game. I don't care for that, really not. Ubisoft had some of the usual stuff. Assassin's Creed now taking place in ancient Greece. Kind of cool. And then the rest was, again, just repeats and sequels and stuff. And then EA was the worst. Entertainment, what is it? EA, Electronic Arts. Lots of sports games, FIFA and NBA, boring. And Star Wars Battlefront will get more Clone Wars stuff and also a Han Solo season with lots of stuff that refer to the Solo movies. That's kind of cool. And they seem to really have stepped away from the loot boxes, at least when it comes to game progression. So that's a good choice, I think. And then finally, you got Square Enix, and they talked about stuff which was not really interesting. And then what I wanted to see, namely a glimpse of the Final Fantasy VII remake, was totally missing in action. So yeah, kind of lackluster, I have to say. It wasn't the E3 that I hoped it would be. But then again, can't have it all. Perhaps next year. Time for the Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
Here at the Peculiar Bunch, we're always happy to tell you everything you wanted to know about Catholics and their tradition, but you were afraid to ask.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
And with Father's Day just around the corner, I wanted to talk a little bit about God the Father. And what's the deal with that?
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
Now, a lot of us that have grown up, or a lot of I say us, but there are so many different people listening to this show. Catholics, Christians, mostly were brought up with the concept of God the Father in their prayers, in church. They hear about that. But what we often don't realize is that it is still a very rare way of calling God compared to other religions, major religions. For instance, in Islam, they would never use Father for God. God is, in a way, at least to my eyes as a Catholic, much more a distant concept. God is the all-powerful, all-knowing. He's a creator. He's a judge. He's a sustainer and an ordainer of the universe. But they wouldn't call him Father. It's also because the word Father implies, of course, a relationship. You are only a father if there are children, or if there is a child. And for Islam, that would clash, of course, with the concept of the uniqueness of God. And so it would be heresy to call God a father. In Judaism, it's a little bit more nuanced, in the sense that they will use the word father as a metaphor for God in some situations. But it would be mostly as the fatherhood of God would then apply to the fact that God is Father of creation, Father of history, Father of men. But they will not go as far as Christianity that confirms that not only is God Father in a metaphorical way of his creation, of his children, his people, but is also Father in a more specific way, namely the Father of Jesus, his son. And that is a whole new dimension to the fatherhood. Now, how did Christians come up with that? Well, it's very simple. It is because of Jesus. Jesus would talk about God as his father. And when his disciples ask him, how should we pray? He tells them to call God Father. And that is the only reason that we have this concept of God the Father in Christianity is because Jesus himself spoke like that about his Father, about God. And in Christianity, also in Catholicism, the fact that God is both a Father and a Son, and that this Father and Son have a relationship that is personal and is a person itself, namely the Holy Spirit, that Trinitarian view of God does not clash with the uniqueness of God, with the fact that the belief that Christians share that there is only one God, but it's a God in three persons. Now, so there are many different problems that we have to think that. It's a revealed it's something that was revealed in the New Testament to us. Jesus is talking about God as his Father. He is named the Son, and he is talking about the Holy Spirit. And so he is mentioning these three things, and at the same time, Jesus himself is, of course, there's only one God, and there's nowhere that Jesus says, well, there are three of us up there in heaven, and we kind of both take turns, and if my dad is tired, I'll take care of the prayers, and when I'm tired, I'm on vacation with my dad, then the Holy Spirit is at the switchboard. No, there is no indication whatsoever that Jesus believed anything else than that the uniqueness of God. There's only one God, the God of Israel, but also the God who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, the problem is that we have our words, our minds, our theology is very, I think, very able to distinguish what the Trinity is certainly not. It's not three persons. It's not one God who reveals himself in three phases or three modalities. That would be modalism. And oftentimes you will see those heresies pop up. I was scouting the area of my new parish. And so I took my bike, and so my parish gets the pastoral team gets a charge of two parishes. And so I took my bike, biked 72 kilometers to all the churches in the new area where I will also have to serve as a priest. As I came to a smaller church, and it was closed, but they have a website. So I go to the website, and I see that, well, they have mostly Sunday celebrations led by lay people. So apparently they don't have that many Eucharistic celebrations, not many masses. So it was they had a page where you could click on the sermons done by these lay people. And so I'm clicking on Trinity Sunday, and I'm reading a big defense of basically a heresy. It's modalism. It's like Trinity, well, you know what? It's just the way we encounter God, and some people encounter him as a father, and other people are more charmed by the idea of Jesus the carpenter, and then some people are more spiritual, so they'll call God a spirit. And like, oh, that is probably why to become a priest, you'll first have to go through a very rigid and substantial theological formation, because if you don't have good theology, you will fall back into heresies. And I was a little bit shocked to read that, because of course, if that's the only thing you hear on Sunday, you know, who's going to correct that theology? It's risky. But anyway, it's also because we're so limited in our thinking. But that's why negative theology is what, for instance, one of the big theologians in our church history, Thomas Aquinas, always proposed. It's much easier for us to say what God is not than to define what God is, or to grasp what God is. If you can understand it, it's probably not God. But it doesn't mean that you can't say anything about God. What we can say is that it's not one God who reveals himself in three different modalities, but it's also not three persons who happen to, you know, be part of the same building and taking turns. It's at the same time, it's one God, three persons. And one of those persons is called Father. And the reason of that is that Jesus calls his God, his Father, Father. Some people, again, struggle sometimes with that concept of God the Father. And I've in my early years as a priest, sometimes I would be confronted with liturgy booklets that were composed by very nice people, but not very theologically strong. And this was at a time, it's kind of linked to the history of the Netherlands, where we've had a very rough 60s and 70s period in the church, where with all the changes in the liturgy, people were experimenting with all sorts of, you know, writing their own Eucharistic prayers. And liturgy was often seen as a means of self-expression. Whereas, of course, nowadays, that sounds very old-fashioned. It's like, well, of course we have rules. Of course we have a common liturgy. It's one of the most beautiful things of being a Catholic is the fact that no matter where you are in the world, you enter a church, you celebrate Mass, and it's the same language, it's the same prayers, it's the same structure. So you feel at home. It's the same family. It's kind of like when you go to see your grandmother, you have the same pea soup as you eat at home because you inherited the recipe from your grandmother, etc., etc. So in the church, it's kind of that same familiarity. And liturgy as a self-expression has also a big downside, and that is it can introduce all sorts of too human elements, or sometimes doctrine could become just an opinion. And liturgy can become an expression of individual opinions and does no longer have that universal shared heritage. So back then, in my early years, sometimes I would be confronted with Eucharistic prayers, and where they had taken out all the mentions of God Father, and they would replace it by God the Almighty, or sometimes even they would use the Jewish terminology. They would say Adonai or something like that. But the big problem, and then when I was protesting, of course, it was like, well, why did you take out? And sometimes they would even replace the Our Father with another song. And then I was inquiring, oh, why did you take out all the mentions of Father? And it was, well, we cannot force that upon people because some people have very strained relationships with their fathers or something. They, you know, and the whole concept of Father is so manly. And so it's limiting God to this idea of an old man with a beard who is this man, manly man on the cloud. And shouldn't we have a more feminine expression of our faith? And why can't we call God Mother? And instead of praying Our Father, we could pray the Our Mother. And literally, I'm not kidding you, I've had one Mass where they did that. And they had not really the Our Father per se, but they had a prayer to God the Mother. I'm like, well, I can see the problem. I can imagine that some people, the kind of Father that they experienced in their life can be an impediment to understanding or feel associating the word God by calling God Father. That may cause pain, or it may evoke perhaps a flawed image of who God the Father is, because they'll imagine, and I do think that that has been the case perhaps sometimes, that a certain very human vision of what a father is and how a father behaves was projected onto God. And so God is strict, is distant, is formal. You have to approach him in a very formal way. In a certain way, the way that we, in Dutch, when we pray, we use a very formal word, we say thou and thy because, well, You know, you can't call God. God is not like your neighbor. So in French, in English, you don't have a problem because you is the same. Although in old liturgical language, you still have thy and thou. But in French, the French, even though they have tu et vous is for, you know, a more formal relationship, and tu is what you say to your friends. Tu es mon ami, you are my friend. The French use tu for God. And I've learned how to pray in French because I was studying at the time in the French part of Belgium. And that felt so much more closer, more familial, more, I don't know. I felt much more closer to God when I prayed in French than I felt when I was praying in Dutch. And then the weird thing in French is that they will still use vous, so the formal form for the Virgin Mary. So it's very inconsistent. the thing is, what I always try to explain is that, yes, God is a father, but he is father in an analog way, in a sense that it transcends our concept of fatherhood. And every father here on earth is flawed. Look at your own parents. If you are a father, you know how flawed you are. And perhaps sometimes at a certain time in their youth, children will look up to their fathers and think, well, that is what a father is, and or not see the flaws. But the older you get, the more you see the flaws of your own father. But we are challenged to always look at God the Father in a sense that he is father, but in an eminent way that surpasses the flawed versions of fatherhood that we have known in our own lives. And so calling God Father can also help us to heal our concept of fatherhood. God being a father can also be a challenge to regular fathers. You know, be a father like God is your father, always forgiving, always looking at the good in people and not being distant and strict and condemning, but always merciful and always trying to save and to help people grow, etc., etc., etc. Sometimes I think praying to God our Father with, of course, God's grace can help us heal the damage that sometimes a flawed fatherhood has caused in our lives. That's kind of what I wanted to share with you here on The Peculiar Bunch. Let's move over to the world of tech.
We are on the cutting edge of technology.
Wow. Well, what does that mean?
Let's plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device. And it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner built... Whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff, it just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
There's always one more thing that replaces purgatory for me here on Earth. And that is everything that has to do with soccer. I'm sorry if you are a soccer fan, but for me, soccer is purgatory. I cannot stand soccer. I cannot. The World Soccer World Cup that's currently going on in Russia, it's taking over the media here in the Netherlands. We are a big soccer country. And so every single day there's this news channel that I often listen to just to hear what's going on in the world. Well, nowadays, from 1 in the afternoon till 10 at night, it is only about the Soccer World Cup. Ugh, purgatory, I tell you. Thankfully, we have modern technology that gives us a window on other worlds, parallel universes, where nobody likes soccer. So if soccer is on TV, I'll just watch Star Trek. Because at least in the world of Star Trek, there is no soccer. Humanity has finally evolved. There's no more money. There are no more wars. There's no more soccer. I think if there's one race that would probably reintroduce soccer in the world of Star Trek, it's the Klingons or the Borg, you know. But it's something that needs to be eliminated. Resistance is futile. That's how soccer feels to me in the Netherlands. Well, anyway, talking about technology and soccer, did you hear that there is this app? I don't know exactly what app it is, but there's this big row about it on social media, because apparently the app will ask you for permission to use your microphone, and it will then use your microphone of your mobile device, your Android device, to spy upon illegal transmitters of World Cup soccer matches. So it's actually that app, once you enter, for instance, a bar or like a public space, it will open up the microphone and it will listen. And if it hears the sound of a soccer match that is aired is on screen in your local bar or restaurant, it will send the coordinates of where you are, and then it will, you know, put things in motion, and that bar or restaurant or cafe will be fined because you need to have a license to air this very profitable World Cup soccer material. And so, of course, people are upset, like, yeah, you can't spy like that. I mean, it's amazing technology. I have to admit that. And it's a technology that they're also considering using and may also actually already be in use for instance, Nielsen ratings in the United States, which is the company that counts the audiences that watch certain shows or listen to certain programs on the radio. Here in the Netherlands, we measure the ratings in a very old-fashioned way. For TV, they have a subset of people. Of course, that's all statistically ironed out. But there's a very small amount of people in the Netherlands that have a box that is put in between their television their provider and their TV screen. And the moment you switch the channel, it automatically sends a signal. It logs what you're watching on your TV. With radio, they can't do that because a lot of radio is still over the air, or it's digital and encrypted. And so for radio, this is still the case today. The people that agree to contribute to this these rating surveys, they actually get a booklet and a pen. And they have to write down, well, right now I'm listening to Radio 1. And right now I'm listening to this or that show. What we know is that those ratings are extremely unreliable, because most of the people, they start enthusiastically, and after a day or so, they've been listening to the radio all day, and then they're like, oh, I should have written down, what have I listened to? And they'll just write down the most popular channel. But it is extremely unreliable. So a lot of radio programs have disappeared because the rating company says, well, nobody's listening. Whereas in reality, it could very well be that lots of people are listening to that. But, you know, the very small survey group is just not writing it down. Well, what they want to introduce now is that the radio group that is producing the ratings for radio, they will get a watch that will be able to listen. And so it will constantly have the microphone on, and it will log what you're listening to. It will have audio recognition, just like YouTube can do that for copyright protection. And it will be able to recognize the programs that you listen to and give the ratings company a minute-to-minute log of what people are truly listening to. And a lot of my radio colleagues actually are convinced that if they would measure radio usage like that, the total landscape of radio would change, and they would discover that actually people do listen to a lot of niche programs, or that certain programs will have sky-high ratings, whereas the old ratings would show nothing because people only write down, no, I was just listening to Radio 1 because that's what we have on in the car, for instance. So in that respect, is pretty good. What I, of course, think is very important is that people give their consent if the microphone is constantly on. I remember all the little mishaps that were happening with the Google Home or the Amazon Echo. That sometimes the stuff that the device was listening to was sent to a server and then was discovered. And people I will never let that technology into my house. Well, they forget that the one of the most dangerous devices that you can carry along is, you know, it's not your Amazon Echo. It's not the little webcam on your PC. It's your phone. You give your phone constant axes. Every app, of course, they're gradually improving this whole permission system. But it used to be that, you know, you give an app permission to use your microphone. You didn't even know when it would use the microphone or what it would do with that data. So I think it's very good that we are aware of the privacy risk. And in a certain way, a soccer scandal like the spy app, I think is a good trigger for people to be more aware of the fact that we all have our little spy devices in our pockets, and that the people that are responsible for those apps and for those devices should protect us and should never gather information without our consent. Facebook, Google, everyone. So it's going to be very interesting to see where we will be at in 5 years' time. But I think that the world is now starting to wake up, and especially with the danger of that massive gathering of information and how it can impact our political system and undermine our political system, the way that Russia used that technology to influence the political situation in the United States and probably in a lot of other countries as well, it should be a wake-up call that we need to be very vigilant, because this goes way beyond the tech domain. This is dangerous for our countries, for the stability of our political systems. So, well, there you go. I'll step off my soapbox now, and we'll move over to the world of sports. Sports? Didn't we just talk about sports? Well, I want to talk about personal sports.
What will it be, Mr. Simpson? Your usual bucket of ice cream covered with miniature pies?
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but I'm afraid our facilities are not equipped to meet your needs.
What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm saying, sir, is that a man of your carriage couldn't possibly fit in our seats.
I could sit in the aisle.
I'm afraid that would violate the fire code.
Game? What a game. Oh, a game.
That's a very, very old jingle that I used to play when I was talking about trying to lose some weight, which is exactly the reason that I brought the jingle back, because that is what I'm currently trying to do. I decided to be a little bit more serious about weight loss, and it has to do with my training that will begin this upcoming Monday for the Marathon of Amsterdam, which will take place in October. And I remember the last marathon that I ran was a disaster because I was too heavy. And it's, I think, like every extra pound that you carry along will slow you down for a couple of minutes. And so it was one of my slowest races ever, not to mention that being a little bit overweight and then running is very detrimental to your knees and to your joints. So I decided to start counting my calories and upping the calorie burn. And technology to the rescue, I now have a ton of devices and apps that help me do that. And I'm so proud that I've been able to interlink all these different things, because I have my Wear OS watch, which I use to measure sometimes my workouts. And it's amazing what Google Fit, it runs as an Android watch, but Google Fit is able to recognize your reps when you're doing strength training. This is a very new implementation of their technology, but they use, of course, the motion sensor inside the watch, and then they can recognize what you're doing. Like, I do a little bit of weightlifting, and of course, you have different exercises. I have an app that tells me, shows me even in an animation how to do that, because I don't have a personal trainer, and I don't know. I haven't done much strength training in the past, so I want to make sure that I do it right. And then I was so amazed that Google Fit recognizes what I'm doing. So it sees when I'm doing a deadlift or when I'm, and you can even define your own, like that app has a lot of kind of custom routines with weights. And so I just do the exercise like 15 times and I say, recognize this, and I can give it a name. And then the next time I do it, it will ask me, are you truly doing this, or is it this other exercise? And then you can say, no, it's really this. And after three or four times, it's flawless. It's amazing. So it's this kind of pattern recognition that they applied to their fitness app. And so now I don't have to count the reps anymore. Even the calorie burn can be calculated in a very precise way thanks to this Google Wear OS system. I am so stunned nowadays what technology can do. But I also have a second watch that I use for biking and running. The Wear OS watch has a very limited battery, and so after about 10 hours, it's empty and it needs to be charged. Well, the other day when I did my 72-kilometer bike ride, I'm almost certain, because, you know, that's only using the watch without using the GPS. But if I would fire up the GPS or Blu-ray or any Bluetooth, it usually uses its charge up in 2 or 3 hours. So for the bigger sports things that I do, I use my TomTom watch. But TomTom has its own app, and the TomTom sports app is very cool because it shows you your fitness age. And so, according to the TomTom app, I'm actually almost as fit as other people of my advanced age. So I have a fitness age of 54. I was like, dude, I'm 50. That's already painful enough. Now you tell me I'm 54? But I cannot tell you how much that motivates me to get that age to my real age, and preferably under my real age. The downside, of course, is the TomTom app works very well together with my TomTom watch, but not with the Wear OS watch. And then I use another app, Strava, for biking, because Strava will calculate the itinerary. And then the next time you do the same tour, it will tell you how far your previous self would be at that time. So you can race yourself, which also is very, very cool. You can see your progress because, well, Strava tells you that last week you were not here. You were like 2 kilometers slower than you are now. So it's very motivating. I also use my Fitness Pal, which is a great service to count my calories. But it also, in order to calculate my calories and lose weight, I also need to take into account the extra amount of calories that I burn with the bike rides and the running and the walking and the fitness. And so, in order to do that, I have to interconnect them all, and it works, kinda. Let's say Google Fit is very generous in sharing its own data, but it doesn't really read the TomTom data. My Fitness Pal can be tweaked so it reads everything, but sometimes it will read twice the stuff. So last day I was going on a bike ride, and then it also was counting steps, or what it interpreted as steps. And so I got the calorie burn was way bigger than it was. So I had to manually delete the steps during that bike ride. But the only app that is very good at integrating all that data is TomTom Sports. So that's what I'm currently using to kind of gather everything. But it's just, for a geek like me, it's very motivating to have all this technology that helps me actually do what, you know, previous generations would just do by moving enough. And with that, I think it's time to give you my book review, and then we're going to wrap up. Oh, and then that was the end of the jingle for some reason. I think you have to press it again, Inge. There you go.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
So, I always buy my Kindle books when they are on sale. There's a special page on the Kindle store that will show you the daily deals. And I religiously go through that page because, well, then sometimes it's 90% off. And so I bought a trilogy of books. The first in the series is called Wayward Pines. And it was $1.99, I think. It also had an audio book. Because it's linked to Audible. Audible is also owned by Amazon for almost nothing. So I bought the 3 books and the audio versions of the book. And I've been listening to Wayward Pines, the first in the series, while running and while biking. And it was the strangest thing yesterday. So the story, this is also a series on Fox, a TV series, which I haven't seen yet. But when I read the book or when I listen to the book, it plays like a movie. It plays like a TV series. It's that good. It tells the story of a guy who wakes up bruised and battered. He's been in an accident. He doesn't even remember his name. He's in a hospital. And his memory slowly starts to come back. That almost sounds like a trope. We've seen so many TV series, so many stories with that kind of beginning of the book. But then, he's at one point, he's walking outside. And there is something about that village, about Wayward Pines, that feels off. And he hears a cricket. And he's like, there is something wrong with this cricket. And so he follows the sound. And he tries to find the source, and he doesn't find a cricket. There is actually a speaker, and the sound is coming from a speaker. And it's like, huh. And then nobody in the village seems to know him. He remembers that he is a special agent, and then he's on a federal murder investigation in that village. And he actually comes across a corpse of one of the colleagues that he was looking for. And then he goes to the local sheriff, and the local sheriff is like, yeah, whatever. I don't believe you. You don't have any identification. And then it gets worse and worse and worse. And then in between that, you have flashbacks to, so he's been, as a military, he's been tortured. And so there are a lot of things going on. And as a reader, you're constantly, so what is the real reality? You know, what's going on? And it's very sci-fi. But then he tries to escape from the village, and he takes a car, and he drives. And he tries to move away, and then he is at the entrance of the village again. So I was like, oh, I've seen this. This totally like, what was it? There's this movie where this happens, where the characters are trapped in a 1950s TV series and they can't get away. I think it's Pleasantville, one of my favorite movies. And it feels like that, but more dark. And then it also feels a bit like the Truman Show. Like, is this a real world or is this all a fake world with the crickets coming from speakers and not whatnot? So anyway, I was listening to the chapter where he's trying to escape from the village. And I'm just biking and I didn't have my phone with me. So I had no GPS. I was just driving around. And I kind of know the area, but then I was like, so at the moment that this guy discovers that he tries to run away, and then he's back at where he started with his car. I'm having exactly the same experience on my bike. It's like, I'm back at that one crossroads where I was here 15 minutes ago, and I had no idea that I was going in a circle. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to the right, and I'll see. I just wanted to, you know, bike for about 2 hours, so I didn't really care where I was. And so I'm biking, I'm listening to the book. And this guy tries to escape the village. And then I open my eyes. I had my eyes open. But then I realize where I am. And I'm back at that same crossroads. For the second time, I had done a circle. And I was like, is this really happening? Or am I dreaming? Am I really on this bike? Or am I in this? Is someone else dreaming my story? It was the weirdest thing. That the book that I was reading was reflecting what I was experiencing. And then later on, I came back home and I was like, and now I want to see on the GPS, on the map, what I'd done. And I see two perfect circles that I'd done in that town. And they both ended up at this very same crossroads. So that was the weirdest thing. I was like, I feel like this book is getting way too close to reality. So Wayward Pines, I can't wait to see what happens next. I've read a couple of chapters, but I'm going on a bike ride this weekend to see what happens next. Hopefully, I won't get lost. And with that, I think it is time to start the end jingle, because we have been sharing this time together for about an hour. And I've always said an hour is kind of the sweet spot for this chatter. Don't want to go over it. Hopefully you enjoyed it, and if so, please subscribe to the podcast, and you can also watch this video live every Friday on our Tridio page, Tridio Media, on Facebook and on Twitter. I'll see you next week. Take care. God bless.